Angela.
Corey.
What's going on? How's your day going?
So far so good.
Yeah.
How's yours going?
All right. It's been a good week. You got a joke for us, Angela. Lay it on me.
Why was the mummy so tense?
I don't know.
He was all wound up.
That's a good one.
Okay.
What are a mummy's favorite brand of underwear? Fruit of the tomb.
Okay, last one.
Okay.
What is a mummy's favorite genre of music?
Rap.
Yeah, that one's obvious.
Okay, well, if you didn't catch on to the whole theme, we got an episode about a mummy.
Yeah, and you're probably going to ask yourself, what do mummies have to do with Oklahoma?
Well, ask your mummy.
That was bad.
Well, actually, we're about to tell you. We're having Michael Williams in from the Territorial Museum. We had Nathan in from the last on the last podcast.
So. Also from the Territorial Museum.
Yeah, we're just, they're great people.
Yeah.
And they are very knowledgeable.
Yeah.
And they're right down the road. So, yeah, let's get Michael in. He is kind of an expert on this story, so.
And, yeah, you have to, this is kind of a strange story that I had never heard of. So even up until we started this.
So strap in. We got a yarn to tell you.
A yarn to spin.
Ooh. Around your body, making you a mummy.
No, you don't have to go that far.
Okay. Okay, we're here with Michael Williams from the Territorial Museum. Can you tell me what you do at the Territorial Museum, Michael?
Well, I'm one of the curators at the Territorial Museum, and it's an odd, crazy job, okay? We take care of the collection, of course. We interact with the public just constantly, all the time. We write articles for the local newspapers. You know, we tell stories. We do TV shows. We do things like your podcast here.
Let's set the stage for our topic today, because we haven't told anybody exactly what we're doing
yet. We haven't.
So it's December 8th, 1976. Angela's 20, 30 years old.
Always.
She's hanging out with her good friend Lee Majors, and we're on the set of The $6 Million Man, filming an episode called Carnival of Spies. A prop guy goes to move what he thinks is a mannequin, and an arm breaks off, and he sees human bone and tissue. Can you kind of take the story from there?
Well, yeah, you know, they're, like you said, they're filming an episode of The $6 Million Man. If anybody knows what that is, I don't even think people know what that is anymore.
I hope so. We'll look it up if you don't, because it's a fun show.
Yeah. It's Lee Majors. What was he in the 80s? The fall guy?
Oh, yeah.
The stunt guy. So anyway, they're setting up to do the shot, and they're inside of a fun house. One of the crew knocks the arm off of this mannequin that's painted red, and it's hanging from a noose, you know, from the ceiling of this you know, carnival ride. And, you know, he goes over, and he's going to just tape the arm back on, and he looks at it, and he's like, man, that looks like a bone. Later on, he said the skin looked like beef jerky.
Ew.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of gross, isn't it? He's like, you know, call some of his, you know, the other workers around, and it's like, hey, you know, look at this. Does this look like a bone? You know, and so they go over and they start to examine this mannequin that's hanging from a noose, and they're looking at it. And of course, it's naked. There's no clothes here.
Yeah.
And so they're looking at it. They closely inspect this mannequin. And one of them's like, yeah, you know, this is a guy.
That's a human body.
This is a human male.
I wonder what the reaction would be. Like, I don't, like, you know, what would you do? Would you gag or throw up or?
I don't know. I would probably call the authorities. Which is what they did, right? I mean,
yeah, they did. They called the authorities. I'm gonna kind of establish this early. There's a lot of stories surrounding this body that may or may not be true. They call the police. Police come in, and you know, they're looking at the body also, and they're like, yeah, this is a guy. Okay, we need to call somebody. It's like, who do we call? You know, this is odd. So, you know, of course, they call the detectives. Detectives come, and they're looking at it. And apparently, supposedly, one of them calls for an ambulance because they have an extremely dehydrated man that needs transport. So anyway, the EMTs show up, you know, so they show up and, yeah, we need the coroner. That's who we need to, you know, have come and, you know, see this. So, you know, they get in touch with the coroner. Actually, one of the detectives takes the arm to the L.A. County coroner's office, and they look at it and, you know, officially determine that this is
an actual human.
Yes, yes. They send out a van, pick it up, bring it into the county coroner's office. Now, this is in Long Beach, but there's no, like, Long Beach coroner. There's just the L.A. County coroner. So they handle everything in the county.
Oh,
so
wow.
Everything comes to them.
So at the coroner, Joseph Choi.
Yes.
He's kind of assigned to this very dehydrated guy.
Right, right.
So how do you even, like, begin to start to figure – I mean, because this isn't, like, now or if you can, like, search for DNA or something like that. But how did he even – begin an investigation into figuring out who this body was.
I guess, how do we go from the $6 million man, some weird mummified shriveled body to Oklahoma?
Well, so what happens is they bring the body in and Dr. Choi takes it into an examining room. You know, in his initial examination, he sees that there's been a Y incision on the body's chest. So from that, he knows that this has already been, it's already been autopsied, you know, and it's like,
what's it's not just some random mystery murder or something.
A guy
like
who yeah.
right.
was hung and shriveled on his own. I mean, he
right,
was a
right.
guy who passed on at some point.
Right. They know that there is some sort of, you know, evidence out there as to who this man is because he's being autopsied. They just don't know where, you know, it could be in California. But it could be anywhere. They're not sure. So he starts his examination. He actually has to get like a reciprocating saw to saw through
the beef jerky skin.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, this is, you know, like I said, this is kind of a gross story. You know, I mean, it starts out just, you know, crazy. So anyway, he saws him open and they find some things within the body, you know, that kind of start leading them to where it might have come from.
Yeah, let's go through those because the big reveal is kind of at the end. So explain what a gas check is and how that comes into it.
Oh, I'm going to get, let me get into
okay,
that.
Okay, okay.
Okay, because this is, we're going to do even more big reveals.
Okay, okay.
Okay. So they cut him open and like you said, they find this gas check within the body. And a gas check, it's like a copper sleeve that goes over a lead bullet to make it, you know, spin through the rifling of a barrel.
Oh, okay.
Straighter, you know, so there's less wobble in it. So it makes it more accurate and gives it more, it just makes it more accurate.
Oh.
Okay, so it sails straighter, goes farther, and is more accurate with this soft metal, you know, that's a little harder than the actual lead to propel it. So anyway, they find that in there. And this is a key to the story that we're going to tell later. It's what he puts in his autopsy report is that it's approximately 32 caliber. All right, 32 caliber is going to be very important in all this. All right, but they also in his mouth find some coins, you know, pennies and nickels, mm-hmm. in that have been stuffed in his mouth, and also tickets from this thing called the Louis Sunny Wax Museum. So now they've got a place to start. You know, it's like, who is Louis Sonny?
Right.
You know, we need to figure out who this guy is. They look him up. He had a wax museum in Hollywood, but he also had one that traveled around the country and, you know, things like that. And he made movies. God, you might have seen some of this stuff.
It's all She-Freak was one of
them. She-Freak.
Yeah.
Did you spot him in it?
No, I was.
No,
it's
we
on,
need
the
to
whole
do that.
Thing's
yeah.
on YouTube.
Yeah,
you guys.
Yeah, 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 yeah. We watched it, and it's like at the very end
for a split second,
okay.
right?
for like yeah. that. Yeah, I mean, it's so quick. It's like, oh,
so okay. Skip to the end because I can tell you it's hardly worth it.
Skip to the end. Yes. Oh my God, that is the worst movie. but the movie that was really great that we watched with him in it was called Narcotic.
Ooh, right. I haven't seen that.
Oh yeah, it's on YouTube. You got to watch this because it's all about these hophead, you know, opium
Like Reefer Madness.
Like it's like Reefer Madness because Louis Sonny's actually a partner with the people that make Reefer Madness and all this. Okay. So I mean this is his this is the world he is working in. I think his company is still in business, but they make movies.
Adult films?
Yeah. And they make movies. So they figure out that that they need to find Louis Sonny to figure out who this man is. And of course, when they start looking for him, he's already passed away, but they get in touch with his son, Dan. And he's like, yeah, that's the mummy. Yeah, we used to own that. And so they're like, oh. Ooh.
So his son knew that it was an actual mummy.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Okay. Yes.
I'm just
yes.
curious, like, when did it become, not an actual human, who was that one person that I'm curious who would decide oh, this is a human. Let's, hang him from the rafters and spray paint him red.
Well, there's a long line of people that exploit this body.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's sad. It's sad that people are willing to take somebody that's passed away and use them for their own monetary gain. Mm-hmm.
But he lives on. He lives on.
I don't think there's a but here.
All I'm saying, if I were to survive in perpetuity, I might be.
Well, I'll make sure that you are mummified.
If I'm found on the set of the $6 billion man, maybe.
So they actually track it down to the son, and he tells them what. I mean, he's like, it's a dude.
Yeah, yeah. He tells them he's he knows exactly who it is. They know the name of the man and all this kind of stuff. And, the police are just like, wow, you got to be kidding me. Totally fesses up that, we owned him, but they didn't currently own him. So they'd been in some sort of business deal that went bad or whatever, and they ended up selling all their props. And along with that, they sold the body.
So he was just sold in a lot of stuff.
Yeah, props. Yeah. I honestly think it was like it was almost akin to an auction at a storage facility, type thing.
Yeah.
It
just
was
like a lot of just, things. Yeah, yeah.
Right, right.
A lot of mummies.
Yeah.
A lot of mummies. Yeah, yeah.
So did Lewis's son know the name of the mummy and the story behind him?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah, so, he knew who it was.
Well, let's go back and start at the beginning. Who was this mummy?
Well, his name's Elmer McCurdy, or at least that's the name that we know of him by.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Doing research on the story, he had five or six different aliases that he went with in the time that we know of him. That's the name we're going with.
We're going with Elmer McCurdy.
Yes.
And Elmer McCurdy, he was born in Maine in 1880.
Yeah, yeah. He's born in Maine and, apparently.
So you can't get much further away from Oklahoma than California
and Maine.
So and how did the story, it, yeah.
Well. We will get into that because I think this is a misconception of the time that this is going on, that these people were not mobile.
Right.
And that they did not move and all this stuff. And this was a highly, highly mobile society at the time. People were moving all over the place. Jobs, whatever job you're doing in Maine will say, there's no more jobs for that. Guess what?
Move on.
You move on. The railroads had been expanding, ever since the end of the Civil War. That's still going on in, 1910, 1911. There's a lot of jobs for people that are willing to do that. One of the things that we found with Elmer is that in his enlistment papers, when he joined the Army, he put down as his profession miner. Okay, so, and we know that he had worked in some lead and zinc mines in Kansas and Missouri.
And so we know a couple things about him. We know that he was an alcoholic. Is that true?
Yeah. How do we know that for sure?
I read it in a.
I read it on the internet. It must be true.
Yeah. See, that's the thing. We get, a lot of people talking about him being an alcoholic. Okay. He's. When they robbed the train, one of the things they got were two bottles of whiskey, and they drank them, because it's prohibition, especially in the state of Oklahoma. So, I don't know. I really think that that's more of an assumption. I think he led the kind of lifestyle that would lead him to alcohol and drug abuse, you know, type of thing. So, yeah, he could be. I don't think we can definitively say that he was an alcoholic. We will say that he was drunk when he got killed.
Or, you know,
or at least hungover. The main thing that we found with going back and actually researching this in a scholarly way is that there were tons and tons of assumptions made in 1976 when they found this body. A lot of the things that we know may or may not be true.
Okay.
And so it caused us to start this saying at the museum, it's not the story you think you know. Okay.
But we do know you mentioned his Army enlistment papers. Mm-hmm. And can you talk about his stint in the Army and what particular skills he learned that helped him out in his life of crime later?
Well, and again, this is one of those things. He joins the Army. He had been in Kansas and Missouri previous to this, but then he joins the Army in New Orleans. You know, so he's kind of traveled down there.
Yeah.
You know, what's that all about? How is he there? Why is he there? Is there not a, you know, Army recruiter in Joplin?
Right.
You know, where he can just go sign up some papers if he's so motivated to do this. And one of the skills that you're talking about is explosives. But he's a minor.
He would have had those skills already.
He probably had those skills already.
Around that
He'd
already.
Been around it already. Yeah. So, you know, like I said, people make assumptions. You know, they're like, oh, well, this is probably where he learned how to blow things up.
So what happens after he, does he get, you know, kicked out of the Army, or does he do a stint and then?
Yeah, he just does a stint. He's in the Army and gets out. It's around 1911, I believe. You know, it's, you know, almost immediately after he's out of the Army, him and one of his Army buddies get arrested for having burglary tools in Missouri.
So that's a thing? You can get arrested for having burglary tools?
I guess there's enough tools together that smell like a burglary.
Yeah.
Burglary?
Yeah. So what does that even mean?
Right.
What are burglary tools?
Okay. I guess if I had like a...
You had like a black mask and a big crowbar and a...
A little money sack?
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
Actually, he was arrested with money sacks.
To be honest, you know, those cartoon depictions of these people are probably not that far off. Okay, this is kind of what they're doing. Him getting arrested like this kind of leads me to believe, now I don't know, you know, what anybody else would think, but leads me to believe that he's already involved in something like this previous. You know, we're speculating here, but this is kind of how we get to the real truth of these things, is we speculate on what could have happened and then go and try to prove or disprove.
Mm-hmm.
Give us a brief rundown of his life of crime.
Brief,
that you know of.
That we know of. Okay. What we know of, as far as his life of crime, was he ends up in Oklahoma early part of 1911. He involves himself with a guy he met in jail in Missouri named Walter Jarrett. And this guy is a local criminal. They kind of hook up together and we're going to go and rob some stuff. So the first thing that we know of that they robbed was March 10th in Centralia, Oklahoma. And they break into a general store where they steal some guns, ammunition, they steal money, they blow up the safe. Okay, this is a common thing. They blow up the safe and get whatever they can out of the safe. Next, they rob a train called the Katy, the MK&T, the Missouri, Kansas, and Texas Railroad, outside of Lenapa, Oklahoma. This is all in northwestern Oklahoma. They rob that train. They get away with, you know, I don't know, $500-$600, something like that they're splitting amongst each other. So about $100 a piece.
That's a pretty good haul for back then, right?
Actually, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he's not an unsuccessful. He's kind of portrayed as an unsuccessful bank robber sometimes.
Again.
Or train robber, yeah.
Assumptions. They rob the train outside of Lenapa. They end up spending quite a bit of their ill-gotten gains in this town called South Coffeyville, all right, which is just due south of Coffeyville, Kansas, you know, across the border. So they go and they live it up, you know. And as they're going to Coffeyville, returning from their night out, they apparently get into a fight amongst each other. And so they're having a fist fight in the back seat that ends up being a knife fight in the back seat of this taxi. And, of course, the guy pulls over, kicks everybody out. The cops come. And Elmer ends up with a wound on his wrist. This wound on his wrist comes to the identification process. Uh-huh. You know, because he has a scar from that. And how would anybody know that there's a scar from that? Because there's this thing called the Bertillon system. Back before fingerprints, they used this Bertillon system, and this was created by this man in France, and he figured that you could measure somebody's index finger and the size of their head and the length of their arm and, you know, all these different body parts. You know, you could describe the way their ear looked. And these were things that they could identify career criminals.
Gotcha. All right. So they would keep a record of these identifiers. Gotcha. Yes. So that they could.
Okay. Yes. Okay. And he's the guy that actually develops the mugshot. Mm. Okay. So
that
before
makes sense.
This. Right. Right. And this is late 1880s that this starts in France, and then it kind of, you know, moves across the world, you know. We're now keeping track of
scars, tattoos, measurements,
exactly. So you're getting little files. But, you know, the Bertillon records, that scar on his arm is one of the ways that they help identify him in 1976. They go back to Centralia in April, and they rob the bank. All right, and of course this requires them to blow the safe. They also in September rob a bank in Chautauqua, Kansas, where they blow up the safe. You know, that's the key to all of these robberies is
their MO is they go blow stuff up.
They go blow stuff up. Yeah. Yeah. And then of course we get the Okiza robbery. They you know, stop the train. They blow up the safe. The charge is so strong, it blows the door off, and they're only able to collect about $46. The rest of it had melted to the bottom of the safe.
Wow. Yeah.
Here's where the bumbling, incompetent bank robber comes from. They blow the doors off. They tear the place apart. And one of the things that happens is that the silver coins melt, and they will, you know, form up mm-hmm. in the bottom
just
of the safe.
Just a big pile of silver then.
Yeah. So really, he's not bumbling. It's just kind of the cost of doing business.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. And, you know, we talked about, you know, how much money, you know, $500 from that one robbery. That's a lot. That's a lot of money. $46 is even a lot of money.
Right.
I mean, you know, at the time, you could buy a home for $500.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, you know, 46 bucks is enough for a down payment on a house.
Let's get to Elmer's
last hurrah.
His last hurrah. The last. Was it a train job or a bank job?
It was a train job. Yeah, they robbed a train outside of Okiza. All right. I don't know if you guys have ever been to Okiza or you even know where it is.
I don't. Is that in Oklahoma?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Okay. It is between Bartlesville and Pawhuska.
Okay.
Okay. These guys picked a spot that was remote and desolate and kind of in a funnel where they could control what's going on. And also, people aren't going to hear what's right. going on. You know, they could blow this thing up. Nobody's going to be the wiser. They were looking to, like I said before, rob the Osage oil royalty payment. Now, again, we're kind of assuming this is what they're doing. You know, this is one of the stories that's kind of popped up. But when we looked at the lease agreements with the Osage and the oil companies, the payments would be paid on or about the 5th of the month. Okay, so this is October 4th. So there could be some credence to this. You know, this could be really what was going on. You know, that they're trying to do this. So they stop the train, remove the car, the express car that's going to have the safe in it. They let the steam out of the engine, you know, so the engine can't go anywhere. Mm-hmm. And they blow the safe. They get $46. They end up with a couple of bottles of whiskey. I think they stole a Macintosh, which is a rain jacket mm-hmm. from one of the passengers. They stole a watch, you know, just some other stuff. And I even believe they stole a automatic pistol. A
couple guns, pretty good chunk of money. A small haul, but not... Not terrible.
Yeah. But I mean, this is just what they do, you know. When I kind of looked at it from the amount of money that they pulled in these various jobs and the amount of people that were involved in them, you know, over the course of 9 months, I think he made about $25,000-$30,000 in our money.
That's not bad.
That's not great.
That's more than I make in 9 months.
But yeah, you know, I mean, it's a good lower middle class living.
Yeah.
So they take off. You know, of course, the train builds its steam back up. You know, they get into the station. They let everybody know that there's been a robbery. The sheriff, you know, sends out a posse. They have bloodhounds. They're trying to track them down.
So at this point, it's like the movies. You've got the
running through the forest.
Yeah, the police and the dogs barking, and they're hunting something. They know where they're.
You know, these guys have hours head start on. There's a guy named Stringer Fenton who's after him. And he is a railroad detective at the time. And that's what he does for a living. He tracks people down, works for various detective agencies. He's actually working for the MKNT at the time because of that Lenapaw robbery. So when this robbery happens, he's like, that's our guy, you know, because there's a whole crime spree going on. They were specifically looking for McCurdy. He was the leader of this group. Like I said, they were on a crime spree, and there's the papers are just talking about this robbery spree that's going on all over northwestern Oklahoma and southern Kansas.
So Stringer eventually tracks him down.
Right.
Where does he catch up with him?
Well, what happens is they go and see this guy named Dave Sears, and I think they kind of put the pressure on him. He lets him know that the leader, Elmer, is holed up in the Rivard Ranch that's over on the Caney River. You know, Stringer Fenton, his brother Bob, and another man named Wallace, Dick Wallace. And they go and, you know, he's apparently drinking or had been drinking the whiskey that was stolen from the train and was passed out or sleeping, you know, in the hayloft. They let him know that they're there. You know, eventually is telling them, look, you're not taking me alive. I'm not coming out.
So that's like your classic Elmer. I mean, they're yelling at him. It's early in the morning. I'm not coming out.
You'll never take me alive. You'll never take me alive. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Which, if he'd been a little bit more sober, he might have been like, okay, take me alive.
Right, yeah. Please take me alive.
Well, that or, you know, they show up and just start slinging bullets.
Yeah.
A gunfight ensues. Shooting stops from the barn. Some kid that's there, whether it's, you know, one of the Rivard kids or one of the workers, I don't know, they send him up
to the
look
barn?
Yeah, to go up and look to see, you know, if he's still
what,
alive.
No women were around, so they send the child.
Yeah, okay. It's like, okay, they're not going to shoot the kid. You know, we need to contain him in the barn. We know he's not going to shoot the kid. You know, they find out that he's dead. They get him down, and they put him in a wagon, and they take him back to Pawhuska. When they're there, that's when there's an autopsy done. It's done by this guy named Joseph Johnson.
He runs the funeral home in Pawhuska.
Runs the funeral home, but it's more than just a funeral home. It's like a furniture store. Okay, because
of course it is.
Yeah.
Well, because that's where you bought caskets. You know?
So you're still I mean, it makes sense.
So it went from furniture stores selling caskets to, you know, people embalming and then, you know, splitting into completely different businesses. They identify him, he gets embalmed. The story is that the funeral home knew that no one was gonna claim this body. And so they filled him full of arsenic so that he would mummify and they could use him as a prop to draw business. And, you know, all these that had all this nefarious schemes of what they were going to do with this body. That's really not what happened. You know, they cut him open. They do the autopsy. They embalm him. And then nobody's willing to pay for the burial.
Mm-hmm.
You know, of course, no family came to claim him because...
Kind of a migrant from Maine.
Yeah. So. Well, they don't even know he's from Maine.
Oh, yeah.
You know, nobody knows this stuff. They have him there. And after a time, they finally put his clothes back on him, the clothes he came in, and they stood him up in the corner And people would come into the shop just to look at the body.
Because you got a bona fide outlaw.
Yeah, yeah, and you got a mummy. You know, so this was like date night in Pawhuska. Let's go see the mummy.
Let's go see.
Yeah, it's like yeah, we'll go for an ice cream and visit the mummy. And so, but getting to know the descendants of the family, he tells us the reason that there's so much arsenic in this body is because his great-grandfather had used it to train people on embalming.
So he was using it over and over.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, okay. They actually embalmed it 5 or 6 different times. Okay. You know, just okay. to kind of, you know, so he could teach.
Show how you actually do the yeah. mechanics
yeah,
of embalming.
Yeah, right. You know, they just used it as a tool, mm-hmm. you know, to teach his employees
so
and
it's
his
got
family
like
members. And
5 or 6 times the amount of arsenic.
Right.
So our story is pretty much coming full circle. We've got a mummy in the funeral home in Pawhuska that's become, yeah, just by the fact that he's being there, he's already becoming an attraction. So connect everything together and tell us how we get from there to
the Million Dollar Man.
Or to the narcotic film. So narcotic. I think.
Okay, so anyway, Elmer stays at the funeral home in Pawhuska for about 5 years, all right? And you know, this is one of those things that local legend, you know, kind of turns into, you know, regional curiosity and, you know, things like that. So people are coming by. We want to see this outlaw mummy. You know, we want to check this out. This is a curiosity.
So, and he's slowly going from body to mummy.
Yeah, right.
Because it's, mummification takes a while.
Yeah, it takes a while. And, but, you know, here he is kind of exposed to the air and... You know, he just dries out.
Just like beef jerky.
Just like beef jerky. And so, you know, people, of course, hear about it. People come in, they want to buy the body. You know, Johnson's like, no, I can't do that. You know, that would be completely unethical for me to sell this body. But finally, a couple of guys show up. They're like, look, that's our brother. And our mother just died in California, and she wants him to come home and be buried, you know, with her, mm-hmm. her and our father. And, you know, Johnson's like, you know, I just don't know, you know, and you tell me this, but
how do I know?
How do I know? And so they went and swore out affidavits and, you know, all this stuff and convinced some of the other people in town that they were the rightful, you know, owners. He releases it. He releases the body to him, and they leave town. And about 2 weeks later, he's in a sideshow at a carnival in the Texas Panhandle.
Immediately, he's being exploited, which is exactly what funeral home director did not want
to happen.
Yeah, exactly.
So I mean, the worst possible people you can sell the body to.
Right. Even though you know he was exploiting the body too.
Right.
You know, I mean, he was letting people see it because people were curious and they wanted to see it. So he's exploiting it. It's probably good for his business. There supposedly is pictures of him within their collection. Of Elmer sitting at a card table playing poker with Osage Indians, and you know,
they're posing him.
Yeah, they're posing him around town and stuff. You know,
it wasn't completely on the up and up either.
Exactly. I mean, it's kind of like
you're just giving me more reasons why I want to be turned into a mummy.
I know. I totally want to do that. You know,
how do we go from these carnival people, sideshow attraction, to Lewis Sonny?
Lewis Sonny, he was a policeman in a town in Washington State called Centralia. We've already had
Centralia, yeah. Oklahoma.
Yeah. And now we're having Centralia, Washington. So anyway, he's a policeman in Centralia, Washington. He captures a bank robber that had escaped from prison. And he gets this like huge reward for doing this. And he takes that reward, and that's when he goes into making
sort of exploitation.
Their exploitation film. Yeah, exactly. And they're taking on weird topics like, you know, carnival freaks and, you know, so just that
That the little, life of a nudist.
You know, maybe, yeah. Yeah, that type of thing. You know, he is definitely playing to that lowest common denominator, you know, in his films. And apparently he loaned somebody $500, and the collateral was Elmer.
Okay.
All right, so that's how he ends up with him, or at least that's the story they tell.
And then Sonny has business troubles, and Elmer is then sold.
He's sold to a guy named Sonny Singh that owned some stuff in Hollywood. So I think he was the official last owner. You know,
yeah, it wasn't like he owned, it was just the lot.
Right,
stuff.
Right. It's like, I don't even think he, you know, went and was like, oh, cool,
looked at
it's
it.
A mummy.
Maybe purchased Yeah.
Here, we got this stuff, or, you know, we took it, you know, however it got there. He had taken it in as collateral, and then they owned it for about 35 years. All right, so it was a long, long time that they had it. During that time, he was in the narcotic movie and She Freak. And those are about 30 years apart, you know, because Narcotics made in the 1930s, mm-hmm. and this is late 60s.
So how does he end up making his way back to Oklahoma?
Okay, so how he makes his way back to Oklahoma, which is a great story in itself. Okay, so we're in Guthrie, Oklahoma. There's this group of guys that would meet in the editor's office of the Guthrie Daily Leader. At the time, the editor's a guy named Bill Layman.
This is late 70s,
you know, 1976 is when this is. This is right around Christmas. The director of the Oklahoma Territorial Museum is one of these guys. His name's Fred Olds. And so he's there with Bill Layman and Glenn Shirley. And Glenn Shirley is a outlaw and lawman historian that wrote books in the 70s and 80s. And there's another man in there, a banker named Ralph McCalmont. And so they're in there having their coffee. It's like a Saturday morning. And, you know, of course, this stuff comes over the wire, you know, that they found this mummy in, you know, California. And, you know, they think that he was killed sometime between 1905, which is when gas checks, you know, come out, and 1930, which is when they stopped using arsenic and
embalming fluids.
Glenn Shirley's like, well, I know who that is, you know, because what he did was read through newspapers and collect these stories. And so he had files on all these different outlaws and, you know, and things like that. He's like, I know who that is. This is a guy named Elmer McCurdy. This is what happened. Fred apparently gets kind of incensed about it. He's like, well, what are they going to do? What are they going to do with this body? And, you know, one of the guys is like, well, you know, it's California. They'll probably just cremate him. And he's like, well, we can't let that happen. And he's like, well, why?
You know,
What's it to you? He goes, well, that's one of ours. And we need to get him back here. He needs to be here. You know, Ralph McCalmont and Bill Layman are kind of like, huh.
Man, that's not a bad idea. I smell some good publicity.
Yeah, this might not be a bad idea. And they're like, you know, so they kind of keep hounding Fred. They're like, well, Fred, you need to do something. You're the director of the museum. You should be able to, you know.
Get that body back, yeah.
Get that body back here. Picks up the phone, has him, you know, connect to the LA County coroner, and he tells him, he's like, well, we know who this is. You know, we want that body, you know, just all this different things. The coroner's office in California is like, no, we don't know what to do with this thing. You know, if they want him and you can prove that it's who you say it is, then
why not?
Okay. But you got to prove to us, you know, we're not just going to take your word for it. So that's where this guy, his name's Clyde Snow, or Dr. Clyde Snow, comes into the picture. And, you know, he's looking at the slides and, you know, of the lung tissue. And he tells me, he's like, I'm looking at this lung tissue. He was so well preserved that you would have thought he'd died 3 days before. You know, it was so well done, and, you know, things like that. Mm-hmm. And they match it up. He's like, yeah, this is him. Everything you're telling me matches. You've got Bertillon records showing the scar on his wrist. And here's a scar. You know, you've got this autopsy that was done in Pawhuska, you know, and this is what they're saying happened. Mm-hmm. And this is what we're finding in this autopsy. The superimposition is you know, verifying that this is the right guy, you know, so everything matches. And they bring him back. They fly him in. They actually flew him in on TWA on 89ers Day in 1977, April 22nd. They have a funeral. And they bring in this horse-drawn hearse. And all these people have their horses, and they're dressed up like cowboys, and they're wearing guns, and, you know, they're carrying shotguns. And the sheriff of Osage County at the time is the head of the procession, and he's riding a horse, and he's got a double-barrel shotgun, and, you know. And
they made a really big to-do out of this, it sounds like.
They made a big to-do about it. They get him to to Summit View Cemetery, where he's buried.
That's in Guthrie, right?
That's in Guthrie, yeah. Summit View Cemetery in Guthrie, Oklahoma. And he's buried right next to Bill Doolin.
So another outlaw.
Another outlaw. And they're lowering him down in this pine box, you know, with their lassos.
And you hear, "I'm not dead."
Yeah, just scratching.
There's been a mistake. Hey, guys.
So, you know, that's what they do. And, you know, then later on, we get contacted by, you know, Mysteries at the Museum. Mm-hmm. All right. And they want to do a show on Elmer. And they're asking us if we have anything. And it's like, no, we don't really have anything on him in particular. But we do have this collection from Stringer Fenton. And so that's where we end up finding that we have the gun that kills him in collection. Okay. And so I'm looking through our files and reading the different books. And one of the books quoted this newspaper saying that he was killed with a automatic revolver. Do they mean like a double action revolver, or are we talking just an automatic pistol? You know, what are we talking about here? And so I pull out this collection from Stringer Fenton, or from his grandson, and in it is two automatic pistols. All right. One of them is a Colt 1911 45 caliber automatic pistol. And the other is a Luger. And you look in our records, and it was a 9mm Luger. I'd seen the gun before. Everybody that worked there had seen the gun before because it was in our storage. I, like everybody else, had assumed that this was just a, you know, World War II souvenir. Nobody really gave it any thought. When I start going through the actual papers, so we start using Gateway to Oklahoma History, mm-hmm. you know, from the Oklahoma Historical mm-hmm. Society. And so I'm looking for Elmer McCurdy, and it's like, man, you know, there's some stuff, but there's just really not. And then it hit me, and it's like, you know what? In 1911, Stringer Fenton's the hero, not Elmer McCurdy.
So maybe you need to be looking him up.
So maybe we need to be looking him up.
Yeah.
Okay. Because now Elmer McCurdy's the hero of this story. But at the time, it's Stringer Fenton. Just almost immediately. All right. Tulsa World. And it's like, you know, October the 15th, 1911. And one of their reporters, you know, spots Stringer at the train station. And so he asks him about the, you know, the event. And he goes, well, you know, blah, blah, this happened. And then a bullet from my Luger automatic pistol.
So it's right there in
so
black and white.
Right there in black and white. And I was like, yes, this is it. So, you know, we figured it out. And you look at the autopsy pictures. He talks about the bullet from his Luger automatic pistol going through his right suspender and then carrying through to his left hip.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, which is exactly the path. And you look at the autopsy drawings and you can see the bullet path and all this, and it's like yeah, we got the gun, you
know? Wow,
we've totally got the gun that killed him.
Why don't mummies take up hobbies?
I don't know.
They're too wrapped up in their work.
That's weak.
Is it? What did the mummy say when he smelled rotten eggs? He says, "What sphinx in here?"
That's my speed. I like that. Okay, well, that's all the mummy jokes. Thanks for listening to A Very Okay Podcast. If you like what we do here, write us a review in iTunes, and we'll see you in 2 weeks, folks.
Yeah, I'm excited about the next podcast.
Yes, we are covering... do we keep these secret anymore?
I don't know.
Why do I do that?
I don't know why you do that. It's just silly. Not a secret.
Yeah. We're going to cover... we're going to talk about Black Wall Street in Tulsa, which was... a very amazing place and a very amazing time. So.